Everybody for being here, and well, I will speak of a joint work with Benoît Grébert of the University of Nantes, and it is some work on Birkhoff normal form for PDEs, say. Just to give you the flavor of what I am going, the kind of result that I am going to present, I give you a short summary. That is, I will present essentially an abstract Birkhoff normal form theorem with estimate of the remainder that applies to some semilinear partial differential equation in bounded domains, and that allows to describe the dynamics of the system over long times. Long times means over a time scale of order epsilon to the minus r, where typically epsilon is the size of the initial datum. So I think I am going to speak of small amplitude solution of amplitude epsilon and to describe qualitatively the dynamics. And the typical result is that the solution remains closed, essentially moves on a finite dimensional torus over this time scale. And moreover, if you have initial data that are smooth, say in that are of norm epsilon in some Sobolev norm, then their norm at most double over this time. Over this time scale. So you get some control on the transfer of energy to higher modes. I will focus mainly on the abstract theorem because during the week Benoît Grébert will speak on the applications, but just to have some concreteness, let me mention the fact that the typical application are to nonlinear wave equation with Dirichlet or periodic boundary condition on a segment, and also to say, I think that quite general semilinear equation in one dimension. He will present also some application to nonlinear Schrödinger equation, and to some particular equation in higher dimension. And here I mentioned, I wrote down two examples of equation in higher dimension that can be, whose dynamic can be described in using this method. Well, you will see why essentially there are some limitation to the application to higher dimensions. But first of all, I would like to start by reminding something on Birkhoff normal form theorem in finite dimension, just to point out what is the main point of the game. Birkhoff normal form, well, I am dealing with an Hamiltonian system having an elliptic equilibrium point, so essentially a system of harmonic oscillators, plus some higher correction. And I will denote by H0 the Hamiltonian of the linearized system, the square part of the Hamiltonian, and P the perturbation. And Birkhoff's theorem states that it is possible to find the canonical transformation that simplifies a lot this system, and in particular that simplifies a lot, excuse me, up to any wanted order. So if you fix the order of normalization R that you want to reach, there exists a canonical transformation that conjugates the system to a system with the linear part plus some normalized part plus a remainder. And the normalized part a priori is only known to commute with the square part of the Hamiltonian. And from this one can deduce, for example, that the normalized part depends only on the actions if the system is non-resonant, for example. This is, say, again, an abstract result. Consequences are immediate to be obtained in the non-resonant case. Namely, if the system is non-resonant, then the dynamics of the action is essentially is due only to the remainder. So every action moves with a velocity that is very small, And one can easily deduce from this that the norm grows very slowly, and also some other information. I mean, the norm is a sum of the actions. So if you take the time derivative of the norm, you immediately find that it is something that is very small in a ball of a very small radius. And so you use essentially this quantity as a Lyapunov function, or if you want, you write a differential inequality for the norm, and you find that, for example, up to times 1 over epsilon to the r plus 1, the norm at most doubles, the norm of the initial datum at most doubles. Let's say it is multiplied by a constant that you can control. In this case, it is not particularly meaningful, since you already have a Lyapunov function, but in the infinite dimensional case, it becomes relevant. And the second point is that if you take, you can control the dynamics of each of the actions, and you can show that they move very, very little up to a quite long time scale, since their time derivative is small. As a consequence, you see that if you define a torus that is essentially the level surface of all the actions, then the solution remains close to this torus up to the time scales you are studying. So So the kind of result that you deduce is not that there exists invariant tori. For this you need something more that is well known now to be KM theory, but you get some tori which are approximately invariant. You get that for any initial datum of small amplitude, it approximately lies on a torus for a finite but long time scale. And this is the main difference also with KM tori, with KM theory, that this kind of results give a result for any small amplitude initial datum, not for initial data on a set of a full measure. So I wanted to give you just an idea of the proof of this result, because I will need this in the infinite dimensional case. And the idea of the proof, let me write something, is the following. I mean, you have your system. Can you see this here? Plus the perturbation. And you want to make a canonical transformation in order to simplify it. So you look for a canonical transformation T, simplifying the system, and you look for the canonical transformation as the time one flow of a suitable Hamiltonian system. So you look for an Hamiltonian function, so that if you write the equation of motion, the Hamilton equation of this auxiliary function, and you consider the time one flow, say this is the solution, Z is the couple PQ, and this is the solution of the Hamilton equation for chi, for the Hamiltonian chi, then you consider the time one flow, and you consider the transformed Hamiltonian. And you want to determine chi so that this is simplified. Now, a simple computation shows that you can find the Taylor expansion of this that is given by the quadratic part plus, the third order part of the perturbation plus something which is the Poisson bracket of chi and H0 plus term of order 4. This is a computation. And the point is that you want to determine chi so that that part of order 3 is as simple as possible. So, so possibly should vanish, and you try to determine first chi in such a way that this is a zero. Well, in order, so you read this as an equation for chi. And it is quite easy to see that this is actually an equation in a linear equation in a finite dimensional space. This can be seen because, well, suppose just to start that to look for chi as a polynomial of degree 3. Then you immediately can see that the operator of commutator with H0 maps polynomial of degree 3 into polynomial of degree 3, and it is a linear operator. So say it is from polynomial of degree 3 to polynomial of degree 3. And then you can read, you can give a name to this operator, and you simply read this equation as a linear equation. In the space of polynomials of degree 3, so it is a linear equation in a finite dimensional space. And just to study it, you have to analyze what is if this operator is invertible or not. And the key point is to look at its eigenvalues and its nucleus, essentially. And what one finds is that this operator has the eigenvalues that are, has eigenvalues and eigenvectors that can be described in a very explicit way. And essentially the point is the following. You can in order to describe the eigenvectors, it is convenient to introduce new variables, new complex variables that I write here. Say to transform from the variable pqs to some variable xi eta by this formula. I just write for convenience. There is something missing, excuse me. It seems to me it is like that. Yes. I write just to write something. I mean, it's not important to remind these formulas. And the key point is that monomials in the variables xi eta are eigenvectors of the operator of Poisson bracket with H0. If I consider a monomial of this kind that I write as usual as psi to the L eta to the alpha, one can see that the operator LH0 applied to one of these monomials gives you simply I omega L minus alpha scalar product times xi to the L eta to the alpha. So that you find that these are the eigenvalues of your operator. And moreover, since L minus alpha is something that belongs to Zn, you can see that if you assume that the system is non-resonant, namely that omega d dot k is different from zero for any k in Zn minus zero, then the kernel of this operator reduces to the case where L is equal to alpha. That means that it is a polynomial of this form, namely a polynomial in the actions. Since one can easily realize that Cj eta j is just Pj squared plus omega j squared Qj squared over 2 square root of omega j. So if the system is non-resonant, then one has that the kernel of this operator depends only on the actions, and all the other eigenvalues are given by these quantities. This means that if one has to solve an equation of this kind, one has to divide the components of P3 by these eigenvalues, by these numbers, and if you are in a finite dimensional setting, then this is a finite dimensional space. So for any finite order, for example, for order 3, you have that the infimum of these quantities is bounded away from zero, and you have no problem in doing anything. Then you can iterate the construction, and you get essentially Birkhoff's result. Now, what's the problem to extend this result to infinite dimensional system? The point is that you have to divide, again, by these quantities, omega dot k, but now you have that you have still the limitation that you have here, namely, I forgot to mention this, it is that if you work in polynomials of degree, say, a number r, then this number k is subjected to the limitation that it should be smaller than r because of of the way it is constructed from the indices. And it means that you have to control the infimum over these quantities for a set over this set. And as I mentioned, in the finite dimensional case, this is a finite set and the infimum is different from zero. And in the infinite dimensional case, typically this is a zero. You have infinitely many possible choices of k in z infinity, and this typically accumulates to zero. So this is the key difficulty. But before showing how one can tackle this problem, let me make the connection with infinite dimensional systems, just to remind a simple model that everybody knows is the nonlinear wave equation, the nonlinear string equation, say, in one dimension, and you can put, for example, periodic boundary conditions on a segment. Then to recognize that it is an Hamiltonian system, you simply expand U and its time derivative in Fourier series, and you see that the Fourier coefficients are essentially the variables P and Q of harmonic oscillators. Then this is an Hamiltonian system, and the Hamiltonian of the system has the form that we discussed before, just the only changement is that we have now infinitely many oscillators. What we learn from this example, essentially, is the kind of phase space one should study. Mainly, the point is that if one is interested, for example, in studying this equation, in the string equation in Sobolev spaces, then the P and the Q's corresponding are the Fourier coefficients, so one introduces norms that are the typical norms, weighted norms for sequences that correspond to the Sobolev norms. Now, let me come, please. Oh, okay. Does it work? Okay, now what is the main point? The main point is to try to exploit the fact that if you are dealing with Fourier coefficient of a smooth function, they have a quite fast decay with the index k, with the index of this. And the way to exploit them is to make use of the Thame inequality. Well, I'm not sure this is the correct name that appears in literature, but well, let's give a name for the moment. What? Convolution inequality. Well, I heard it sometimes called Moser and another. Composition of functions inequality. Yeah, you can get this essentially by intersection, by using the Leibniz formula for the computation of derivatives. Well, the key point is that the HS norm of U square is estimated by the HS norm of U and the H1 norm of U. So you have only one derivative of one of the two functions. This is one dimensional. This is one dimensional, yes, of course. Excuse me? For all S larger than 1/2 here, if it is one. I mean, you need the algebra property of HS, then everything goes. It's really easy. You use the interpolation inequality and you get it. If you remember, you do it, otherwise you... And then the remark is that if U has only large Fourier coefficients, so it has an expansion that starts with some large n, then its H1 norm is small. Is small as it can be easily seen because the sum started with a large index, and so you have an estimate of this kind. Essentially, the H1 norm of a function whose Fourier coefficient start from the nth one is estimated by the HS norm divided by 1 over n to the power s, essentially. And this means that the HS norm of U square is small because of this quantity if U has Fourier coefficients that has an Fourier expansion that starts only with the Fourier coefficients. So the idea is to try to exploit this property to say that, let me change, to say that if you have the nonlinearity of your system, a large part of this nonlinearity is not relevant since it is already small. And more precisely, the idea is that if you have a general U and you decompose in a part with large Fourier coefficients and a part with the small Fourier coefficients, then if the nonlinearity is local, it involves only the powers of U. And so you can write it in this way. And the point is that if U bar appears at least once, then the norm of this guy is already small. This means that you have to care among all the terms obtained by this series only, well, here I made a mistake, essentially it should be one, this, only of the terms, no, it should be two, only on the terms that are linear in u hat and the I mean, it's better to write it. You have an expansion that, say, u is equal to, say, one that I called u bar with a small Fourier coefficient plus something with large Fourier coefficient. And if you have a power, then the only two terms that you have to care are u hat to the power n plus n u bar u hat to the power n minus 1. Because all the other terms are already quadratic in u bar square, and so they are small due to the previous game. So, essentially, a large part of the nonlinearity is already small, and the point is that people among you who are familiar with this fact will immediately realize that you need a kind of second Melnikov condition to eliminate terms of this kind, since variables with large index appear only linearly in the vector field. Please. Excuse me? Sine nx, of course. Yes. I do not understand the point anyway. We can discuss. Okay. So, no. HS. HS because it starts with power n. But probably what you mean is that if it is a sinus, you could have problems because of the zero term appearing. But if, here I have just the exponential, the large exponential. Good. So where I am? Here. So to exploit this property, essentially you need two informations. You need to check whether the property of the tame inequality persists in the iteration, and to find a good non-resonance condition in order to eliminate what must be eliminated. And it turns out that, well, we found some condition that allows, that persists in the iteration and that allows to, how do you say, to control the vector field of the perturbation. To define, this is the condition we called of tame modulus. To define it, just remark that if you have a polynomial function, then you can expand it in Taylor series, write it in this form, and you can define its modulus simply as the polynomial in which all the coefficients are taken with the modulus. This is a game that was introduced by Nikolenko, as far as I know, many years ago, or by Zender, even, maybe. And then the remark is that in the finite dimensional case, if in the finite dimensional case, this is always well defined, but in the infinite dimensional case, the modulus of a polynomial can be unbounded even if the polynomial is bounded. Then you can extend the definition to polynomial vector fields exactly in the same way, just taking the modulus of each component. And essentially the assumption that was done by Nikolenko and that is extended in this case is that this is a bounded polynomial. I will assume not that this is a bounded polynomial, but that the same properties hold for this polynomial. Just the same property in general has this formulation. If you have an homogeneous polynomial of degree R, you can write it as a multilinear. You can find a multilinear function, an R multilinear function associated to this polynomial, and you say that it satisfies the same property if the HS norm of this multilinear function is estimated in terms of H1 norms of the input and only one time the HS norm. You can read this, but it's better to see the example U square, where U square is the polynomial and the multilinear function is UV. And, well, here I made a mistake. Forget this term. And simply you have that the estimate of the HS norm of UV is given by this estimate. HS norm of U, H1 norm of V, and so on. And one says that the polynomial has the same property if this holds. And the assumption for the abstract theorem is that it will be this, namely, needs the definition of tame modulus, the tame modulus if the modulus of the polynomial has the tame property. The main theorem is the following. Assume that any Taylor, consider the perturbation, expand it in a Taylor series, and truncate it at any order. You assume that any polynomial, any truncated polynomial, has tame modulus. Then the system, well, I forgot to mention the definition of gamma alpha of normal form, say. Then the system can be put in normal form up to any fixed order. I forgot this point. Should I have? Good. I write. What kind of normal form? The idea is simply: you eliminate all the polynomials quadratic in higher order variables that do not involve two small denominators. If they involve a very small denominator, then you keep them. So the point is, if you have a function z, which is a function of the variable, a polynomial function of the variable xi eta I introduced before, then you say that it is in gamma alpha n normal form if the following holds. Just to fix ideas, n is the difference here between variables with small index and variable with large index. And the point is, so first of all, you separate the variables xi in variables with small index and variables with large index. So xi bar is equal xi j smaller or equal than n, and xi hat is equal to j larger than n. And then you expand writing the difference between variables with a small index and large index. So you consider something like that. And you say that this is in normal form if you have that a coefficient is different from zero only if it corresponds to a very small denominator. So only if omega scalar product with, only if, first of all, it involves at most two variables with large index. So only if k plus l, not k, is smaller or equal than 2, and if omega dot j plus k minus the small denominator corresponding to this term is, the small denominator corresponding to this term is smaller than this quantity, gamma divided by n to the alpha. Then, and I try to conclude. Excuse me? Can you repeat? No, it's infinite dimensional theorem. N is now just a parameter, fix gamma, alpha, and n. Then you say that this infinite dimensional polynomial is in normal form if this thing's old. And the theorem says I should say something on the quantificators maybe. Says that given gamma, alpha, and r, there exists n, which is a function of the order, so that this is in gamma, alpha, normal form up to the given order, say. You need the assumption that the original Hamiltonian is of class C infinity. It is enough to have a C infinity Hamiltonian. Then you make a polynomial expansion, you truncate it at the order R you want to reach, and then you work with the truncated Hamiltonian. So you actually work with an analytic Hamiltonian. If this is the it's the standard definition that goes through to infinity, it is not affected by the dimension. So the question is, what can you do with this normal form? And the main thing you can do is that if the frequencies are non-resonant in some way, then you can deduce some informations. And, I try to close quite quickly. So, essentially, if it happens that... Good. So, if you split the frequency vector into a part which are the frequencies with small index and the frequencies with large index... Namely, you consider the frequency vector and you split into the part with a small index, the truncated finite dimensional vector, and the remaining part, say all the other. Then you assume a kind of second Melnikov condition of this form. Let me explain just a moment what is the point. The standard second Melnikov condition goes as follows. Well, usually you have to estimate this kind of small denominators from below. This is a constant. provided if K and L are fixed in at a finite order, typically you have only a finite number of small denominators of this kind under some growth condition, so this can be bounded below from by some constant. In KM theory, what you need is to take this R and to push it to infinity. So this is a constant that depends on R. You fix the dimension of the tori, that is the index n, and you are interested in controlling this constant from below as a power of R, typically of the order in KM theory. Here you are not interested in pushing the order to the infinite, but in pushing the dimension of the torus, if you want, to infinite. So instead of doing that, you consider the dimension of this constant, the dependence of this constant on n, and you are interested in bounding it from below at fixed r. And so you assume that this goes to zero as a power of n of the dimension. And this is the assumption that has to be checked, the non-resonance condition. Suppose it is true, then one can show that the normal form is non-resonant in the standard sense, and therefore one has all the consequences that are typical of the Birkhoff normal form in finite dimensional systems. So all the actions, if epsilon is the HS norm of the initial datum, then at most it doubles over a time scale 1 over epsilon to the R, and all the actions are controlled. And moreover, one can show that there exists a finite dimensional torus with the property that if the initial datum is small in norm HS, this the solution remains close to the torus in any norm smaller than the original one. This is true for any S1 bigger than zero. So you have a small loss of control, essentially. This I don't know whether it can be improved. Up to now we did not succeed, at least. Walter, how much time can I speak? Good. I just mentioned what I would like to say, and then I don't say what I would like to say. And it is that this is an abstract theorem. So the point is how to verify its assumption. Are its assumptions something that are generally true or not? Are they easy to check or not? And so the game is to provide some tools to verify the assumptions, essentially. And let me go. So the point is that it is quite easy to verify the tame modulus assumption, because essentially we showed that it is stable under the composition of maps, and it is stable under some changes of basis that are of the category usually that one usually meets in partial differential equations. So essentially, Benoit, I think, will present all the things needed to verify the assumption. But there are a few properties that are easy to verify that allow to apply the theorem. Finally, the non-resonance condition is usually difficult to verify because it involves infinitely many frequencies. And it is a genuine infinite dimensional condition, and it can be verified in some cases like the nonlinear wave equation of this kind, because essentially in this case the the frequencies are the eigenvalues of a Sturm-Liouville problem. And one can show that it is possible essentially to tune the frequencies using the mean value of the potential. So one has a result of the kind that the non-resonance condition is fulfilled, provided the mean value of the potential is in some Cantor set. I would like to mention just maybe one last thing, is that the theorem applies also to periodic boundary conditions, and in this way the system is almost resonant. You have, as usual, the frequencies that are asymptotically double, and so you pay some price, and the price is that you allow exchange of energy between modes with a similar frequency. And let me mention the last point. The last point is higher dimensions. Higher dimensions, the point is that it is easy to show that the nonlinearity has the Tame modulus property in equations of this kind. What is not so easy to verify of this kind is to verify, in this case it is easy to verify the non-resonance condition. But since it is a kind, and the kind of result you get here, excuse me, is that the normal form in this case is completely non-resonant. But this is due to a further property of this equation. In the general case, you have to allow exchanges of energy between modes with similar frequencies. Yes, the kind of result here is for almost all these in a suitable probability measure, you get that this can be put in normal form up to any order, and the normal form is non-resonant. And for example, but again, it is due to the fact that the frequencies cluster in separated points. If the frequencies are dense on the real axis, it's difficult. So the typical example we are not able to deal with is the nonlinear wave equation, where the frequencies have some bad behavior. Well, so I would like to conclude here, and I thank you.